They capture podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling a really big one, Karl Marx's Das Kapital. I mean, this book is legendary, controversial. It's definitely shaped history.
It really has, and it can feel intimidating, right? So our goal in this deep dive is, well, to give you a clear path through it, we want to get to the core ideas from this huge 19th century work.
Yeah, bypassing the political noise, maybe, and focusing on Marx's actual analysis.
Exactly. We're zeroing in on his central argument that capitalism inherently exploits workers through something he called surplus value.
Surplus value. Okay, so that's our mission. Understand what that means and why, you know, it's still relevant for things like income inequality today.
Absolutely. Because Marx wasn't just complaining about capitalism. He was trying to figure out how it worked, scientifically. He wanted to find the underlying rules, the hidden mechanics.
Hidden mechanics, I like that. And that framework, well, it's surprisingly useful for looking at today's economy. The gig economy, automation, corporate power, all of it.
All right, let's start with the man himself. Karl Marx, 1818 to 1883, philosopher, economist, socialist. What made him uniquely positioned to write this massive economic critique?
Well, it's the combination, really. He wasn't just an armchair philosopher. He had this deep philosophical training, Hegelian dialectics, looking for contradictions.
Okay.
But he combined that with decades, literally decades, of intense empirical research.
So not just theory. He was looking at hard data.
Totally. He was living in London, often in poverty, seeing the Industrial Revolution up close. And he spent endless hours in the British Museum, digging through government reports, factory statistics, economic texts.
Wow.
He really mastered the existing economic theories like Smith and Ricardo so he could build his critique on solid ground. It's that blend of philosophy, lived experiences in exile, and just rigorous data diving that gives Das Kapital its edge.
That makes sense. That dual approach explains why it feels so thorough. So stepping back, what's the book's main goal? What did Marx set out to do?
Fundamentally, Das Kapital aims to reveal the, let's say, laws of motion of capitalism, to show how it functions underneath the surface.
Like finding the operating system?
Kind of, yeah. He argues it's a system driven by one thing above all, the need to accumulate capital, to grow constantly. And he aimed to show scientifically why this system, due to its own internal logic, might eventually lead to revolutionary change.
Okay. And you mentioned his journey starts small, right? It's just a product.
Yes, the commodity. Something produced to be sold. Seems simple, but Marx uses it as the starting point to trace how exchanging these simple things creates the whole complex, often exploitative, structure of capitalism.
And this brings us back to that key idea, surplus value. That's the engine, according to Marx.
That's the core mechanism. Surplus value is essentially the profit that comes from paying workers less than the actual value that they create during their work time.
Mm-hmm.
The system depends on extracting this unpaid labor.
Okay, let's get into the nuts and bolts then, starting with the commodity. Marx says it has two sides.
That's right. First, there's use value. Simple enough, it's how useful something is. A chair is for sitting, coffee is for drinking. It's about its physical properties, its utility.
Qualitative.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then there's exchange value. That's its price, basically. What it can be traded for in the market, usually represented by money.
But how do you compare apples and oranges or coats and corn in terms of value? They have totally different uses.
That's the million-dollar question Marx tackles.
Yeah.
And this is where his labor theory of value comes in. It's a concept he adapted from classical economists, actually.
Okay, what's the theory?
He argues the common element, the thing that allows us to compare diverse goods, is the human labor required to produce them. Specifically, the value is determined by the socially necessary labor time.
Socially necessary, meaning average time.
Yeah, basically the average amount of time it takes to make something under the usual conditions, with the typical level of skill and technology available at that time.
Mm-hmm.
This lets him argue that value is created during production, not just when something is sold.
Got it. That sets up a crucial distinction he makes about how things circulate. He talks about CMC.
Right. CMC is simple commodity exchange. Think of a baker. They sell a commodity, bread C, for money. Then use that money to buy a different commodity, flour C. The goal is consumption, meeting needs.
Makes sense. But capitalism flips that logic.
Completely. The dominant circuit becomes MCM. You start with money M, use it to buy commodity C, crucially, raw materials and the ability to work, labor power.
Okay.
Then you use those to produce something new, which you sell for more money, M, that little prime symbol, the extra bit of money, M prime. That's the entire goal.
Accumulation, not consumption.
Exactly. And Marx asks, where does M come from? If you buy inputs at their value and sell the output at its value, how do you end up with more value? It looks like magic, or maybe cheating, on the surface.
Which leads us away from the market and into the factory, what Marx calls the hidden abode of production.
Precisely. Because the secret ingredient, the source of that extra value M, is one specific commodity the capitalist buys, labor power.
The worker's ability to work.
Yes. It's unique because its use value is to create new value. And crucially, the value it creates is more than its own cost, the wage paid to the worker.
Okay. So the wage covers the worker's basic needs, allows them to survive and come back to work tomorrow.
Right, the cost of reproducing their labor power.
But in the time they actually work, they produce more value than that wage represents, and the capitalist keeps the difference.
That's surplus value, exactly. Marx divides the workday. Necessary labor time is the portion where the worker produces the value equivalent to their wage. The rest is surplus labor time, where they're essentially working for free, generating profit for the capitalist.
And capitalists naturally want to maximize that surplus labor time. Marx identifies two main ways.
Yes. The first, historically more basic way, is absolute surplus value. Just make people work longer hours.
Like the infamous 14-hour days in early factories.
Exactly. The big struggles over limiting the workday were fights against this absolute extraction.
But the more, maybe, sophisticated method is relative surplus value.
Right. This is about making labor more productive within a given workday. You introduce new technology, streamline the process, increase the intensity.
So the worker produces the value of their wage faster.
Precisely. If technology lets a worker make their wage equivalent in, say, 2 hours instead of four, then even if the workday stays at 8 hours, the surplus labor time jumps from 4 hours to six. More profit without obviously extending the day.
That feels incredibly relevant now. Think about productivity software, algorithmic management.
Absolutely. Technology under this system isn't primarily about making life easier for workers. It's often about reducing necessary labor time to boost relative surplus value. It explains that feeling of constantly needing to do more faster.
This relentless drive for more surplus value, more M, has wider consequences too, right? Like unemployment.
Yes, Marx discusses the reserve army of labor. It's a stark concept.
It sounds pretty grim. What is it?
Capitalism, through technological change and periodic crises, constantly creates a pool of unemployed or underemployed workers. This reserve army serves a crucial function for capital.
How so?
Well, their presence puts downward pressure on the wages of those who are employed. Fear of replacement keeps workers compliant, and it gives capital a flexible pool of labor to draw on when it wants to expand quickly. It's not an accident. It's a structural feature.
A necessary byproduct of the accumulation process.
According to Marx, yes. And speaking of origins, he fiercely rejected the idea that capitalism just arose from hard work and saving. He talks of primitive accumulation.
Right. This isn't the story of the thrifty becoming wealthy.
Not at all. Marx argues the preconditions for capitalism, owners of capital on one side, propertyless workers on the other, were established through historical force and violence.
Like the enclosure movements in England.
That's his prime example. Common lands were privatized, peasants were kicked off the land, losing their means of subsistence.
So they had nothing left to sell but their ability to work, their labor power.
Exactly. It created the free laborer, free in the double sense, free to sell their labor to whomever they chose, but also freed from any other means of survival. It was often a brutal process of expropriation. And Marx prompts us to think about how similar processes might still be happening today.
Okay, let's shift from the mechanics to the bigger picture themes. What are some of the core messages or insights beyond the economics?
One of the most influential is the fetishism of commodities. It's a fascinating idea.
Fetishism? What does he mean?
He means that in a market society, our social relationships, the connections between the people who produce things, get disguised. They appear to us as relationships between things mediated by price.
So we see the price tag, but not the labor or the power dynamics behind it.
Precisely. We treat market prices like natural facts, like gravity, rather than the outcome of specific human interactions and power structures. It masks the exploitation inherent in the production process.
That definitely makes you look at shopping differently.
It does. Another huge theme is the central contradiction Marx saw. Production becomes increasingly social. Large factories, complex supply chains, thousands cooperating.
Right, very interdependent.
But the appropriation of the wealth generated remains private, concentrated in the hands of the owners. This mismatch between social production and private ownership, for Marx, is a major source of instability and crisis in the system.
And this leads to his idea of historical materialism, the notion that economic systems aren't permanent.
Exactly. He argued that history progresses based on how societies organize production.
Yeah.
Capitalism, with its internal contradictions, is just one historical stage, not the end of history. He believed its own dynamics would eventually lead to its transformation into something else.
Driven by material conditions, not just ideas.
That's the core of it. The economic base shapes the social and political superstructure.
You know, beyond the dense analysis, Marx could really turn a phrase. The book has some incredibly memorable lines.
Oh, absolutely. He was a powerful writer.
Like the very beginning, setting up his whole approach. The wealth of those societies presents itself as an immense accumulation of commodities. Its unit being a single commodity. Starts micro to explain the macro.
It's methodical. And then there's a definition of capital itself, shifting focus from stuff to relationships. Capital is not a thing, but a social relation between persons established by the instrumentality of things.
That's a powerful reframing. And probably the most famous, that really captures the exploitation angle.
The vampire one.
Yeah. Capital is dead labor, that vampire-like, only lives by sucking living labor and lives the more labor it sucks.
It's visceral, isn't it? It really drives home the point that profit, in his view, is extracted directly from the worker's time and energy.
So bringing this all home, we've unpacked this dense 19th century text. How do these ideas help us understand our world today in the 21st century?
Well, take the idea of relative surplus value. It directly addresses why, even with massive productivity gains from technology, wages haven't kept pace for many people.
Because the gains are captured as profit.
Largely, yes. According to this framework, the goal is to reduce necessary labor time, boosting profit, not necessarily to share the benefits widely through higher wages or shorter hours. This directly informs debates about things like the gig economy, worker surveillance, burnout.
Automation, too, presumably.
Definitely. And his broader analysis of accumulation and crisis helps make sense of persistent global inequality and why economies seem prone to booms and busts. The reserve army concept helps explain precarious work and wage stagnation.
It gives you a structural lens rather than just seeing individual successes or failures.
Exactly. And commodity fetishism is a powerful tool for critical thinking, prompting you to ask why the market produces certain outcomes, whose interests are served, and what power dynamics are hidden behind the price.
For me, I think the most striking thing was really grasping that MCM circuit, seeing the market not just as a place for exchange, but as this engine relentlessly focused on turning money into more money. It just reframes everything.
It's a fundamental shift in perspective.
Yeah. And understanding that drive seems crucial if you want to tackle issues of economic justice.
I agree. And for me, the lasting value is the method itself. Whether you agree with all his conclusions or not, Marx provided a rigorous scientific framework for analyzing capitalism. He showed how to look beneath the surface to find the underlying structures. That approach, trying to understand the system to potentially change it, remains incredibly powerful.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by a Contra Foundation.